Have you ever been to Hopkinsville, Kentucky? Do you even know where Hopkinsville, Kentucky is? Have you ever even heard of Hopkinsville, Kentucky? Well, I have, because it happens to be the birthplace of my father. Happy birthday, Dad, kind of a month late. But it's also a very significant spot for another reason, because it's quite near to the birthplace of someone you've probably heard of. His name was Jefferson Davis. Yep, that same guy who led the Confederacy throughout the Civil War and who, at least in terms of constitutional definitions, was very much a traitor. But of course, there are many people who consider him a hero, including perhaps those who erected the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional. And this week, it's all about Jefferson Davis.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
I was recently on a trip near the old family stomping grounds in western Kentucky near Hopkinsville, and out of the cornfields from a distance of, my gosh, 5 miles away, I saw a remarkable sight. It's a sight that's made many people look at each other in their cars, scratch their heads, and wonder, have we taken a wrong turn somewhere? Because it looks very much like the Washington Monument rising from the farmland. It's not, of course. It's a replica. It's a replica that's significant nonetheless. It's several hundred feet tall, and it is a monument to that other great American you might have heard of. His name is Jefferson Davis. Yep, you heard me right. The fellow who left the United States government and led a rebellion, an armed insurrection against the government of the United States, something we call the Confederacy or the Confederate States of America. It turns out that Jeff Davis was born near Hopkinsville, Kentucky. He was largely educated there, and he returned there several times throughout his life. And so it's strangely appropriate that that's a place to have his historic, state historic site. And it's also appropriate that we visit it.
My name is Ron Sidnor, and I'm the manager of the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site. And so I manage this park.
You are the boss.
I'm the boss.
That's right.
Yeah. And what we try to do is, you know, when our guests come in, we give them tours in the tower, and we also have a museum where they can go through and read about the chronicle of Jefferson Davis' life and some of the things that he's done. There's a short video in there on the building of the monument and how it came to be. And then I also end up doing a little education as we go, because people come in with preconceived notions and stuff, and I have conversations with them. And by the time they leave, you know, they say, well, I got to go back and read my history some more. So.
Well, you sound our kind of guy then. Let's start at the beginning then. Who was this guy, Jefferson Davis, who has a memorial here?
Well, Jefferson Davis was born here.
Okay, well, that makes sense then.
Yes, he was born here June the 3rd, 1808.
Right here or in Hopkinsville, which is just down the road?
No, there's a church right outside the park here. Mm-hmm. Bethel Baptist Church is sitting on his actual birth home site.
For heaven's sake.
Yeah, his father owned 600 acres here. His father was awarded a land grant of 600 acres for his service in the Revolutionary War.
Okay.
And so in the late 1700s, 1793, thereabouts, his father had a farm here, and he raised thoroughbred horses, and they also owned a bed and breakfast called the Wayfarer's Inn. And like I say, Davis was born here June the 3rd, 1808. He was the fifth son, but the youngest son of 10, or the youngest child of 10. In 1811, when Davis was three, his father heard about the farmers further south getting rich off of cotton. So he sold everything here and made the long 800-mile trek to St. Mary's Parish in Louisiana.
Okay, is that where Davis grew up then?
Well, no. He grew up in Mississippi.
Okay.
Well, what happened was they were in Louisiana for about a year before his father realized a grave mistake he made because of all the swarming mosquitoes.
There were no porch screens back then.
No. And so they sold the property there, and they moved to Wilkinson County, Mississippi, where he built Rosemont, and that's Davis's childhood home.
Okay.
Now, Davis started school at the age of five. His father was a big proponent of education. Mm-hmm. Well, by the age of seven, his father wasn't happy with the standard of education in Mississippi. So at the age of seven, his father made a drastic decision and sent Davis back to Kentucky at the age of seven, where he, right outside of Springfield, Kentucky, there was a school there called St. Thomas Aquinas College. Mm-hmm. And it was ran by Dominican friars. And so from the age of 7 to the age of 9, Davis was a student there until his mother missed him so much that she begged her husband to bring him back home. Mm-hmm. So at the age of 9, he went back to Mississippi and finished his schooling up there. And by the time he was 14, he came back to Kentucky, where he entered Transylvania College in Lexington, Kentucky. And at the age of 16, he graduated with honors.
Okay, so he really is a Kentucky boy, born here and returned here and partly educated here.
Yes.
Okay, even though he's often not necessarily identified with Kentucky. Okay, please go on.
Well, his father, one of the senators from Mississippi by the name of Rankin, owed his father some favors. So his father pulled strings and stuff and got Davis appointed to West Point. Mm-hmm. So at the age of 16, President Monroe appointed Davis to West Point. So Davis graduated from West Point at the age of 20, 23 out of a class of 33. Mm-hmm. And so from there, he went to the Wisconsin Territory as a young lieutenant. And so when he got, and that would have been in the fall of I believe it was 1828.
Mm-hmm. So Wisconsin was still kind of on the frontier then.
Yes. Mm-hmm. 1829, in the spring of 1829, the new commanding officer arrived, which was Colonel Zachary Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Familiar name.
Yes. Well, Zachary Taylor sent Davis down to the mouth of the Sac River to help strengthen the fort down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so Davis was down there until about 1831 when Taylor brought him back to Fort Crawford. And at this time, Taylor's family was there. And Davis saw Sarah Knox Taylor, Zachary Taylor's daughter, mm-hmm. fell madly in love.
Mm-hmm.
And so they courted and everything, and a lot of other young men tried to court her, but Zachary Taylor had this thing that if you was going to court his daughter, you had to do it in his parlor with him sitting there.
Forgive me.
Yes.
I understand that times were different and that might have been more common back in the day, but...
Right.
It's kind of hard to think of romance under those circumstances.
Exactly.
With Dad sitting there staring at you.
Well, it didn't bother Davis.
Oh, really? Okay.
No.
Okay.
Davis still courted her in the parlor. Well, you know, as things progressed, well, you know, they got to the point where they decided they wanted to get married.
Right.
So Davis asked Taylor for his daughter's hand in marriage, and Taylor said that I vowed that my daughters would not marry a man in uniform. Because they would be destined to live a life of poverty. And he was basing it off of his life and his oldest daughter's life, who married an Army surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And so Davis kind of shrugged that off and kind of let it go, but he kept courting her because, like I said, they were in love. Well, there came a time after the Black Hawk Wars, there came a time when... a court-martial was called.
And for Davis?
No, not for Davis.
Oh, okay.
Another person. Well, Zachary Taylor appointed Davis, Major Smith, and another new lieutenant to the court-martial board, and Taylor was the senior member of the board. Well, when he convened the board, the new lieutenant didn't have a uniform. And so when Taylor asked him where his uniform was, he said, well, sir, they haven't arrived from St. Louis yet. You know, and so Taylor was going to postpone the court-martial until the lieutenant got his uniforms, and Major Smith disagreed. So they had a conversation there. Taylor said, okay, let's put it to the vote. Well, Davis voted with Smith.
Uh-oh, against Dad and Dad-in-law?
Well, against potential Dad-in-law.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Oh,
well, needless to say, this made Taylor mad.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, it made him so mad, he told Davis, he said, not only you're not allowed to court my daughter, you're not allowed to talk to her, you're not allowed in my home, and you're not allowed to speak to me unless it has to do with military matters.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and then there came an opportunity for him to send somebody to... Fort Gibson in Arkansas to join the Dragoons. Well, he promoted Davis to first lieutenant and sent him to Fort Gibson. Thinking that
that's a good way to get rid of an unwanted suitor, isn't
yes,
it?
Well,
you're going to Arizona.
Yeah.
And Arizona was very much.
Well, it was Arkansas.
Arkansas. Yes. I misheard you. Arkansas is still pretty far west, too. And
yes.
It certainly is far away from Wisconsin.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, he thought the distance would cool the romance. Well, it didn't. It made it worse.
Uh-huh.
And so while Davis was in Arkansas, and if I can back up just a moment, when he was in Fort Crawford in Wisconsin, Davis almost died from the weather.
Mm-hmm.
It got cold and everything, and he almost died.
Mm-hmm.
His manservant by the name of Pemberton nursed him back to health and almost lost him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, back then in the Army, there part of the regulations were if you were susceptible to the weather, you didn't have to go to formations and stuff like that. So at in Arkansas, at Fort Gibson, it was Christmas of 1834. The commanding officer of the Dragoons was a major by the name of Moore. And he, on Christmas Eve, he called a formation. Well, it was raining and it was cold outside. So Davis didn't go to the formation. So Major Moore called him in his office and asked him, why didn't you come to my formation? He said, sir, you know I almost died from the weather, and regulation says that I don't have to attend the formations because of that reason. Well, Major Moore told him, well, I don't care what the regulations say. If I hold a formation, you will be there. Well, Davis had a few choice words.
Davis sounds like he was not a very good politician at this stage in
but
his
he
life.
But he was a great orator.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he had a gift for gab.
Right.
And
gift of mouthing off. It sounds like, but go on,
yeah.
Please.
Well, the so the major confined him to quarters and court-martialed him.
Mm-hmm.
And well, Davis decided to defend himself in the court-martial. Well, by the time Davis got through ripping Major Moore apart, they transferred Major Moore out and dropped all the charges against Davis.
That is remarkable.
Yes. And, well, Davis at that time then submitted his resignation from the Army effective June the 30th, 1835.
Mm-hmm.
Well, during this time this was happening back at Fort Crawford in Wisconsin, Sarah Knox Taylor was going through it with her dad. You know, she was going, I can't believe that, you know, you won't let me marry this guy. You know, you're being bullheaded and dotted. I don't care what you say, I'm going to marry him. Well, back then, sons didn't talk to their fathers that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you got the daughter talking to dad.
It sounds to me like they're two very strong-willed young people.
Yes, they mm-hmm. were. So she sent a message to Davis and asked Davis to meet her at her aunt's house outside of Louisville, Kentucky. So Davis left Arkansas and went to Louisville. Sarah Knox, under the cover of darkness, left Wisconsin and went to Louisville. So when they got there, Davis said, I don't want to wait to get married. Let's get married right away. So on June the 17th of 1835, they got married.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Taylor family was there except for Zachary. And
so it wasn't completely an elopement. I mean, they did invite people.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So Davis takes his new bride back to Mississippi, only to get there to find out there's a yellow fever epidemic going on.
Mm-hmm.
So he leaves there and they go to Louisiana, to get away from the yellow fever epidemic. Well, as tragedy would have it, they both contracted malaria, and 3 months into the marriage, she was dead.
Oh, that is sad.
Yeah.
That's very sad.
And so from 1835 until about 1843, Davis was in seclusion. Nobody heard from him or saw him.
Mm-hmm.
He went back to
how long was that?
From 1835 to 1843.
For 8 years?
Mm-hmm.
For 8 years,
yes.
He was so grief-stricken
yes.
that he went into seclusion.
Yes.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're on a visit. We're on a field trip to the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site near Hopkinsville, Kentucky. After the break, we'll come back and speak some more with the manager of that site, Ron Sidnor. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're on a field trip. We're on a visit to the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site near Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and we're speaking with the park manager, Ron Sidnor. Before the break, we were talking about Jefferson Davis's early life, including his romantic life, and when he lost his first great love, his reaction to it. It seems he went into seclusion for 8 long years.
Well, in 1843, his oldest brother, Joseph, talked him into going into public life. And so, and at the same time, he introduced him to Verena Howell of Natchez, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Well, he started courting Verena Howell and ran for the House of Representative seat. Well, in December of 1845, he wins a seat in the House of Representatives, and he and Verena Howell gets married. So Davis goes on to Washington to take a seat as a representative.
Okay, now we have to pause there. This guy was obviously very well-connected, or his dad was. I mean, all going all the way back to West Point, right, and getting the appointment mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. And then, of course, going into seclusion is something you can only do if you can afford to do it.
Well, they
were pretty wealthy,
weren't
they?
Their family was considered an aristocratic family.
Aristocratic family,
yes.
Okay. So now, and in fact, having been in seclusion all those years, today, of course, a candidate might have to explain that, what you've been doing for 8 years.
Yes, exactly.
But in those days, he's from a prominent family. He's got a recognizable name. Okay, so now I understand how he could get elected to Congress. So now it's 1843 or 5.
1845.
And he's heading off to Washington, D.C.
He takes a seat in December. He takes a seat in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Well, it was short-lived because in June of 1846, the Mexican War kicks off.
Right.
So Davis resigns his seat and goes back to Mississippi to fight in the Mexican War. Well, when he gets...
This is a guy who didn't like being in the Army. He didn't like being in the Army, but he's going to join the Army.
He didn't mind being in the Army, but he...
Just didn't like showing up to formation.
Right. He got a sour taste in his mouth with what Moore tried to do to him.
Right.
So he goes back and... The governor of Mississippi appoints him a colonel in charge of the Mississippi Volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Mississippi Volunteers had already been formed, and they was waiting for him in New Orleans. So when Davis gets to New Orleans, his men were upset because they had these old musket rifles, and they had no confidence in them. And so Davis heard about this new rifle called the 1841 percussion rifle.
Mm-hmm.
So Davis procured these rifles for his men. Well, the Secretary of Defense told him, said, no, you can't use those rifles because they haven't been battle-tested yet. Well, Davis went over his head to the president, and the president said, yes, you can have them.
Now, were those cap-lock rifles as opposed to the earlier flintlock rifles? Is that what we're talking
yes.
about? The mechanism with the firing mechanism mm-hmm. was superior.
Okay. Yes.
Quicker reloading, quicker firing.
Reloading, and plus you didn't have as many misfires because of rain. See, that's the problem they had with the old ones, because when it rained, you're putting
powder in an open pan, and if
yes.
it's raining, it's going to get wet and nothing's going to happen.
Exactly.
Okay, so a cap is going to be, in fact, if I understand correctly, I'm no expert on this, and I realize that this is a little bit technical, but the caps are kind of like the caps that little boys used to play with in their cap guns. The same sort of thing. I mean, you'd have sort of a self-contained little bit of explosive powder.
Yes, yes.
Instead of just making a noise, it would actually ignite the powder in the barrel, and it would...
Same concept.
Okay, same
yes.
concept. All right.
Yes. So Davis, after he got the okay from the president to keep the rifles, he goes back and he trains his men. He teaches them how to aim straight and fire the weapons and everything. Well, he also created a movement called the Wedge Movement. The Wedge Movement is so effective, we still use it in our military today. So they go off to Mexico.
You mean a maneuver, you know,
it's
an actual
a maneuver.
For troops?
Yes.
What, can you tell me a little bit about that Wedge Movement? I don't really know what it is.
The Wedge Movement, the Wedge Movement is, you got troops,
uh-huh.
and they come together like this.
Uh-huh, to a point. Uh-huh.
And it flings out just like this, just like a wedge.
Right, okay, so when you're
and
moving
forward.
So when
forward, they move like that.
That's very interesting, and Davis is credited with inventing that.
Yes.
Rather than moving in a straight line.
Right.
Well, I'm no military hero, but I was in the Army, and I do recall that when we did our training, that was pretty much the formation we were using in the 1980s.
Right. And see, I was a Marine for 20 years, and we used it.
The same sort of thing, and the guy in the front's called walking point.
Yes.
Right, and that does give you a better field of fire, and it does, mm-hmm. yeah, okay, well, that's interesting. So that
yes.
came from, okay.
Yeah, so they go on to Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Well, would you know that he's placed under General Zachary Taylor's command?
He can't get away from
yeah,
Zachary Taylor.
Yeah. So they talk and have a few words and stuff. And so Zachary Taylor told Davis where he wanted him to set up.
Mm-hmm.
So Davis goes and sets up and everything. And, well, lo and behold, he's been attacked by the famed Mexican Caparison Lancers, and he's outnumbered 4-1. Mm. And Davis himself said that when he looked down in the eyes of his troops, it looked like they were getting ready to run. Mm-hmm. And he stood tall in the saddle, and he yelled out, "Mississippians, stand fast." Mm-hmm. And they stood fast, and they fought flawlessly. And they defeated this unit. Mm-hmm. Davis was wounded in the process. So Davis comes back home in 1847, a war hero. And so in 1847, when he comes back home, the governor of Mississippi appoints him to a Senate seat that Senator Spate had vacated through death. Mm-hmm. And so Davis served that term out and ran for Senate again and won another six-year term. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1851, when the elections for the governor of Mississippi came up, the Democratic Party wasn't happy with the candidates they had. So they got rid of him, and they went to Davis and asked Davis to run for governor. Well, Davis, you know, he said, "Hey, well, look, this is September. The election's in November. You're not giving me enough time to set my platform." But they kept after him, and Davis said, "Well, you know, my party was calling on me, so I had no choice." So he resigns from the Senate, and he goes back to run for governor. Mm-hmm. Well, only to lose by 999 votes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So he's given up a safe Senate seat.
Yeah.
And he's come back, and he's lost a close election for governor. Ouch, that hurts.
Yes. Well, so he goes back home to be a farmer. You know, he's happy with that. He did some election work for Franklin Pierce doing his campaign and everything. And so when Franklin Pierce won the presidency, he appointed Davis as Secretary of War in March of 1853. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that happened during the Pierce administration that those 4 years has never happened again in the history of our country. All the members of his cabinet that he appointed, none of them got fired and none of them quit during that four-year period.
Really?
Yeah, they all served their terms. Now, Davis as Secretary of War, you know, and if I can back up just a moment, when he was in the Senate, mm-hmm. He suggested they buy the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm. The isthmus where the canal was. Okay.
Yes.
Right.
He suggested that they buy Cuba.
Right.
And he was on the committee that negotiated trade with China and Japan. Mm-hmm. And then he was the head of the military committee that's responsible for the Senate Hall, the House of Representatives building, and the aqueduct system in the nation's capital.
Okay, so he's pretty forward-looking, and though it might sound extreme today for a U.S. senator to suggest we buy Cuba or we buy the Isthmus of Panama,
right.
This was a period, you have to remember, in the mid-19th century when territorial expansion, manifest destiny,
yes.
was part of the air.
Absolutely.
So it was not that odd to be casting the Americanized South and saying, let's buy that and get this mm-hmm. and take that. And in fact, the Mexican War had been a war to a great extent, you know, people argue about it, but a war of conquest where we'd taken about, I think, a third or a half of the Mexican territory.
Right.
So this was the spirit of the times. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so now, as Secretary of War, Davis enlarged the army by four regiments, two infantry and two cavalry, the 1st and 2nd Cavalry. Well, the 1st Cavalry became famous because of their fighting against the Indians in the West. Well, the other thing that made them famous is that, and this has never happened again in the history of our country, 16 officers out of the 1st Cavalry all became generals in the Civil War, regardless of what side they fought for. They all became generals in the Civil War.
Very interesting.
We've never had that many general officers come out of one command since.
You know, that's very, very interesting. I'm reminded of a parallel. I think it was the class of 1915 at West Point. People refer to that class as the class the stars fell on because the timing worked out. They became the senior leaders in World War II,
right.
You know, 20-some-odd mm-hmm. years later, 30 years later. And I guess the timing was right for those guys, too.
Exactly.
I mean, if you're getting to the top, you're getting to the top of your game in the mid-1850s, well, war is on the horizon.
Right.
Okay. So,
exactly.
Okay, that's understandable. All right.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things that Davis did as Secretary of War is he created what he called a Committee of Three. Mm-hmm. Well, George McClellan, who later became General McClellan in the Civil War, was a member of that Committee of Three. Mm-hmm. And their job was to go to Europe and observe the Crimean War.
Mm-hmm.
And what they specifically were supposed to observe was the use of their weaponry mm-hmm. and their tactics.
Right.
And they were supposed to bring that information back to Davis.
Right.
And Davis used that information to build the United States Army.
Well, again, that sounds very forward-looking. It's sort of standard practice now, and it has been for decades, for military officers of one country to go and observe the maneuvers of another one.
Absolutely.
And he was one of the guys who thought of that idea.
Yes.
Again, a fairly forward-looking fellow.
Right.
Okay.
Now, Davis is also responsible for the Army pension plan, which mm-hmm. I'm retired from the military, so I'm grateful for that. So
I bet you. Yeah. You are. Exactly right.
He also established the Army Medical Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So people that's in the military whose family can have access to military medical, well, he's the one that established all of that.
Mm-hmm.
He also had the Western Frontier surveyed for the implementation of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he also created the Camel Corps.
The Camel Corps?
Yes.
Now, this is something of which I have never heard.
Yes. Well, he created the Camel Corps because he wanted to use the camels to resupply the forts in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Congress laughed at him, said he was crazy. So he said, okay, let's put it to the test. So he got two camels, and they got two wagons, one pulled by horses and one pulled by mules. Well, first of all, right off the jump street, each individual camel carried a larger load than the wagons did.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, they were supposed to go from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
The camels were the only ones to make it to point B.
Then that sounds like it was tested out. But then why don't we see camels all over the American West? I guess Congress still wasn't willing to fund it?
Well, no, they funded 300 of them.
They did, 300 camels.
They had 300 camels. He had 300 camels. Now, it is sad that the descendants of those camels are still running wild in the Texas desert and southern Arizona desert. Mm-hmm. Now, I've spoken to people from Texas who tells me that that is true and it's against the law in Texas to hunt them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've talked to somebody else here just recently that from Texas that told me that they had rounded them all up and moved them out of Texas.
Oh, okay.
That'd
be interesting to see where the camels are, the descendants
right.
of the Camel Corps.
Right. Uh-huh. And see, and he was going to purchase another 300,
mm-hmm.
but secession came about.
Right.
But the funny thing about the Camel Corps is that when they got the camels over here, they couldn't get the camels to work.
Really?
Right. So they had to go back to the country they bought the camels from and hire these guys to come over to get the camels to work. And according to what Davis said at the time, to speak camel to the camels.
To speak. Well, I mean, it makes sense. These are people who have dealt with camels for many years. I guess they know how to train them.
Right. Well, you know, and I told my wife that story, and I said, yeah, right. And my wife goes, no, stop and think about it. You know, if we went to Germany and took our dog, and somebody says something to a dog in German, a dog wouldn't understand it.
Oh, I suppose that's true.
I said, okay, I'll give you that one. So Davis, in 1857, leaves the post of Secretary of War and goes back to the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on January the 9th of 1861, Mississippi succeeds.
Mm-hmm.
But just before Mississippi succeeded, in 1858, Davis tried to stop secession.
Oh, did he? He was opposed.
Well, he was a reluctant secessionist. He
uh-huh.
was opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had the governor of South Carolina and the governor of Georgia called him a traitor because of it.
Really?
Yeah. And so when asked why he wanted to stop secession, well, Davis created that army. He knew what that army was capable of, and he knew it would be a bloodbath.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to put the South through that.
Yeah.
And so the leaders of the South laughed at him. And so he's in the Senate on January 9th of 1861. Mississippi meets to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And when they succeeded, when they voted to succeed in Jackson, Mississippi, they went out and they raised a blue flag with a white star in the center over Jackson, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was an Irish songwriter there by the name of McCarthy, and he was so impressed by it that he wrote the song "The Bonnie Blue," and the flag got the name.
Mm-hmm.
And so Davis, now knowing that, you know, the gig is up, my status has succeeded,
mm-hmm.
well, he, on January 21st of 1861, he gave his famous farewell speech to the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that when he sat down, he dropped his head in his hands, and there wasn't a dry eye on the floor.
Well, you know, that brings to mind something. I mean, think back on this. Davis personally knew McClellan, who mm-hmm. later would fight against him mm-hmm. in the Civil War. He knew a lot of people in Washington, D.C., very personally.
Yes.
He knew these people.
And he served in the Senate with Lincoln.
He
served in the Black Hawk War with Lincoln in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. Yep. He knew these people. He knew them personally. And as you pointed out, he had trained this army. He knew just how powerful mm-hmm. this army was.
Yes.
And now he was going to go back to Mississippi, knowing that war was virtually inevitable.
That's right.
And that he and his new countrymen were going to be facing pretty long odds.
Yes.
So there were lots of reasons for him to hang his head and lots of reasons for the Senate to be tearful. Okay.
Yes.
It's something we sometimes forget. Is this really, I mean, it's a cliche to say it's brother against brother.
Oh, yeah.
But
absolutely.
It really was.
It really was.
It really was.
Right.
Okay.
And, well, when Davis left Washington and was going back to Mississippi, all he wanted to be was the highest-ranking military officer in the Mississippi Army because he felt that's what he was best suited for.
Mm-hmm.
So when he got back to Mississippi, that's what the governor did. The governor appointed him a major general over Mississippi's militia.
Mm-hmm.
So Davis goes home a happy camper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, on February the 5th of 1861, the six states that had already succeeded met in Montgomery, Alabama, which was the capital of the Confederacy at that time,
mm-hmm.
to form the new government.
Mm-hmm.
And when they formed the new government, the question was asked who to be the president. Well, they unanimously agreed that nobody had the character or the morals of Jefferson Davis. Mm-hmm. So they unanimously voted him as the president of the provincial government.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent a messenger to his home. Davis was out in the flower garden with his wife when the messenger showed up. And when he was given the message, and the message said, "Dear Honorable Jefferson Davis, you, on this day, have unanimously been voted in as the president of the provincial government."
Mm-hmm.
Well, Davis said that it felt like somebody dropped a big rock on him because that's not what he wanted.
Mm-hmm. He wanted to be a military leader.
Yes. And, well, his wife was happy because she was going to be the first lady.
I guess so.
Yeah. But
and you pointed out that the Confederate capital was in Montgomery, Alabama, which, by the way, always made a heck of a lot more sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Than moving it to Richmond. Maybe later we'll get to the point where they moved it and you'll have something to tell me about that. But that always made a lot more sense to me. But he's a reluctant president.
Right.
And so what happens then?
Well, the message said, please come to Montgomery, Alabama at your earliest convenience. So mm-hmm. he packed up and he went to Montgomery. So on February 18th, 1861, he gave his inaugural address as a provincial president, or as a president of the provincial government. And around June, they had their first cabinet meeting, and that's when they decided to move the capital to Richmond, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that is stated that they moved to Richmond, Virginia, is because Richmond, being so close to Washington, D.C., they felt that if Richmond failed it would be a huge blow to the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they had the capital there, they would have the resources to protect it.
Oh, so this was just sort of an in-your-face maneuver.
Right.
It was, we're going to put our capital forward because we want to make sure that we defend every inch of the South.
Right.
And by making ourselves, they're sort of planting their flag right across the back fence from their neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And almost daring them to take it away from them.
Exactly.
And that's a very interesting and a very fateful decision because, of course, much of the fighting in the Civil War took place between Washington, D.C. and Richmond.
Yes.
I mean, that whole corridor mm-hmm. was just one battle after another. In fact, I've often thought of at least that, the Eastern campaign, as being just a series of attempts of people to outflank each other. In fact, that's what Gettysburg was,
right.
You know, going out.
Mm-hmm.
But be that as it may, okay, so that was taken pretty quickly. So they didn't stay in Montgomery very long.
No, they didn't stay in Montgomery very long.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Ron Sidnor. He's the manager of a place that you may visit one day. It's called the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site. It's in western Kentucky, near Jeff Davis's birthplace. And we've been hearing some really interesting things about Jefferson Davis. You probably knew that he was the president of the Confederacy, but did you know all this other stuff as well? Stick around. We'll tell you some more. listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Ron Sidnor, a really remarkable fellow who has a remarkable job. He is the manager of the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site in Western Kentucky, and we have been learning all kinds of things about the president of the Confederacy that, golly, I just didn't know. Before the break, we talked about how the Confederacy had its first capital in Montgomery, Alabama. And then very shortly thereafter, Davis and the Confederate government moved to Richmond, Virginia.
Davis, of course, goes into his presidency, and his presidency was embattled because not only was he having to fight the people in power from the South who felt that he was a traitor, but he's trying to put a new government together and then on the same token, having the Northern Army breathing down his throat. So he had an embattled presidency. Davis went through five Secretary of Wars, you know, because he was a Secretary of War and arguably the best Secretary of War this country's ever had. He went through five of them because he knew what they should be doing, and if they weren't meeting that standard, he fired them.
I'd imagine it would be very hard to serve as Secretary of War under Jefferson Davis. Talk about someone second-guessing you all the time.
And as the war went, because Davis gave very few orders to his generals. His generals pretty much had a lot of leeway. They would send back to him what they were doing and stuff like that. And if he agreed, he agreed. If he didn't, they would discuss it and stuff. He relied heavily on Robert E. Lee. He really trusted Robert E. Lee. And so around April the 2nd of 1865... And before I get to that, February the 5th of 1864 in Richmond, Davis's wife, Verena, was riding down the street in Richmond coming from shopping, and she heard this kid screaming. And she had her kids in the carriage with her. So she goes over to check it out. Well, you had this elderly black man beating a 7-year-old black kid with a reed. Well, it upset her kids so much that she got out and stopped the guy and asked him, "Why are you beating this kid?" And he said, "Well, he's my ward. I can beat him if I want to." So she physically wrestled the kid away from him and took the kid to the Confederate White House. And her maid, Ellen, cleaned the kid up and dressed his bruises and scratches and stuff like that. And she dressed him in one of her kid's clothes. And when Davis came home, she told Davis what had happened. Well, Davis went down to the courthouse and procured the kid's free papers. Because they didn't have adoption laws back then, so they couldn't adopt him. But that was that. And paramount was the same thing as being adopted, because he then became known as Jim Limber Davis. And he was with them when they were captured.
Let's talk about that. We get, you were about to mention 1865. Well, of course, eventually the Union armies are closing in. Eventually there's Appomattox Courthouse and the surrender of Lee's army, which wasn't technically the end of the war, but pretty much spelled the end of the war.
Pretty much spelled the end, yes.
So then the Grant's armies are closing in on Richmond, and at a certain point, the Confederate government has to abandon their capital. So what happened with Davis?
Well, what happened was on April 2nd, 1865, Davis is in church when a messenger from Lee came to him and said, "Mr. President, I'm about to surrender, so you might want to leave Richmond."
Yeah, it might be a good idea.
Yeah. So Davis then gets his family together and puts them on a caravan heading to Florida. And him and his cabinet members heads down the Trans-Mississippi, because what Davis wanted to do was meet up with some of his generals that was further south to continue the war effort. Well, at this time, some of the Confederates that had become deserters, and the Union Army under General Wilson, the cavalry under General Wilson, had heard that the Confederate Treasury was with Mrs. Davis. So they went after Mrs. Davis' caravan. Well, somehow Davis got the word. So Davis and his cabinet turned about and rode hard to catch up with his wife's caravan. And
was that true? Did she have the treasury with her? Oh, okay.
No. Davis had the treasury with him.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, he left the treasury with someone in Washington, Georgia. And to this day, nobody knows what happened to the treasury.
So to the mystery of the missing camels, we have to add the mystery of the missing Confederate treasury.
Yes.
Maybe the camels have the money. I don't know. It might be. All right. Okay, so he joins up with his wife.
He joins up with his wife. They're in Irwinsville. Well, they're just outside of Irwinsville, Georgia. And that night, one of his men who had went into town came back and said he overheard talk about them being attacked, and this talk was by the Confederate deserters. Mm-hmm. So Davis tells his wife about it and everything, and so he goes to bed knowing that, you know, at some point or another during the night, they might be attacked. Well, early in the morning, he's awakened by the alarm being sounded that they were under attack. So it's drizzling outside and everything. So Davis reaches over and picks up a raglan, which he thought was his, but it was his wife's. Mm-hmm. And he puts it on, and he goes out of the tent.
That's a coat?
Yes, mm-hmm. It's like a raincoat. Mm-hmm. He goes out the tent only to see Union soldiers encircling the tent. Mm. But before he goes out the tent, he thought it was the Confederates, because he told his wife, "I hope I still have favor with the Confederates that they may not rob you." Mm-hmm. And then when he goes out, he sees that it's Union troops encircling their campsite. So he goes back in, and he tells his wife what is happening. So his wife puts her scarf over his head and begs him to escape out the back. Mm-hmm. So Davis goes out the back, and when he goes out the back, there's a young Union private on horseback that aims his gun at him, tells him to halt. Well, Davis halts, and Davis was probably about from that wall in there to this wall over here from this kid.
25 feet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Davis said that he was thinking, you know, I can rush this kid and unhorse him and get away. Mm-hmm. Well, his wife must have been reading his mind, because she went out, ran out, and threw her arms around his neck. Mm-hmm. And Davis later said that she foiled his chances to escape. Mm-hmm. She probably saved his life, because mm-hmm. the kid was already aimed in. Mm-hmm. And so Davis, of course, then is taken prisoner, and he's put in prison at Fortress Monroe.
Before we leave that, is that where the stories came from, that he was caught in women's clothing?
Yes.
Okay, because
yes.
He had that scarf on his head, and he put his wife's coat on.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it came from.
Okay. So at any rate, he's captured. What happens?
Well, he's sent to Fortress Monroe by steamship. Mm-hmm. When he gets there, now, mind you, all this time, all his life, Davis is suffering from the dregs of malaria. I mean, there was times during his presidency that he was bedridden. He was given orders and stuff from his bed and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was really bad off. Mm-hmm. And by this time, you figure he's in his late 50s right now. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so when he gets to Fortress Monroe, you got four big burly men that throws him to the ground and shackles him. Mm-hmm. Okay, he's put in an encasement probably about this wide and about this long.
Okay, again, 15, 20 feet either way.
Right.
Right.
And so he's put in there, and he's still shackled. They didn't take the shackles off of him. He's got two guards in there with him. He wasn't allowed to see his clergyman or his wife or have any reading material the first 30 days he was in there. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the guards that was in there with him had standing orders that when he laid his head down to sleep, they were to march back and forth by his head so he couldn't sleep. Hmm. Now, the only time, and then they had two guards outside the door and 13 guards nearby. Now, the only time I ever heard of anything like that in the history of man was when Peter was in prison. They had two guards in the prison with him that was shackled to him, two outside the door and 20 nearby. Huh. You know, and so they decided that they needed to bring charges against him. So they appointed two judges, Underwood and Chase. Mm-hmm. And so they decided, well, let's get him for the complicity to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Really? That's what he was tried for?
Well, that wasn't what he was tried
okay.
for. That's what they wanted to try him for. Mm-hmm. Well, they couldn't come up with any evidence. Mm-hmm. So then they went, okay, well, let's get him for war crimes, mm-hmm. talking about Andersonville Prison.
Right. Yeah.
Well, at this time, they had Wirtz, who was a commander of Andersonville, in jail, and he was condemned to die.
Right.
And they told Wirtz that if you roll over on Jefferson Davis and say that he knew about the atrocities that was being committed there, we won't put you to death. Well, Wirtz wouldn't agree with that. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't do that. So they went to the only fallback they had was to try him for treason.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I'll just interject here that that's the only crime defined in the Constitution, mm-hmm. you know, is bearing arms against the United States or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. And that's an interesting question because he had a whole army and he was bearing arms against the United States. So how did that work out for him?
Well, in 1866, mm-hmm. they convened the jury, mm-hmm. the grand jury, And it was the first time in the history of this country that we had an all-black jury. Hmm. And so they indicted him for treason. Mm-hmm. So then they convened the Pettit jury. Mm-hmm. The second time in the history of this country they had an all-black jury. Mm-hmm. And, well, at this point, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, we're not doing it.
So they declined, or they somehow stopped the prosecution.
Yes, they said that Jefferson Davis, nobody knew the Constitution better than Jefferson Davis, and he would rip this country apart.
Yeah.
And so the president then at the time said, okay, fine, that's what you want to do.
Andrew Johnson?
Yeah, this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put a $100,000 bond on him, and only rich Northern Republicans, white Northern Republicans, can pay his bond. Mm-hmm. Thinking that nobody that met that description would pay his bond. Well, Horace Greeley, the famous newspaper man, Vanderbilt, Garrett Smith, and several others came together and paid the bond.
Huh. That's an interesting thing. Did they explain why they did
that? Well, when they asked Vanderbilt and Horace Greeley why, mm-hmm. they said because we believe the South had the right to succeed.
Hmm.
And
that's an interesting constitutional question. We've done a mm-hmm. whole episode on that, and to this day, people still disagree over that basic
right.
question,
mm-hmm.
whether an individual state or a group of states, in this case, could simply say, thanks but no thanks, and we're going to opt out of this Constitution that we ratified.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting constitutional question. There are those who, of course, say today that the question's been answered not by the Supreme Court, but by force of arms. I mean that the Civil War itself was a rejection of that idea. But Greeley and his friends thought that what he had done was within the rights of those states.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So in 1867, Davis is released from prison, and he goes to Canada where his family is.
Canada?
Mm-hmm.
They'd gone to Canada?
Right.
That's an interesting irony.
And so him and his family travels around Europe,
mm-hmm.
And in 1869, the Supreme Court said, hey, that's it, this is done. We're not pursuing any charges on him whatsoever. He's clean. Mm-hmm. So Davis comes back to the United States, where he becomes the president of an insurance company in Memphis, Tennessee.
Hmm. Please tell me about the construction of this remarkable stone obelisk here that's right outside the window.
Okay, yeah. Well, in 1907, Dr. C.C. Brown out of Smith Grove, Kentucky, came up with the idea that there should be a memorial to Davis like Washington has to him. So he went to the governor of Kentucky, who was Simon Buckner, who was a Confederate general during the Civil War, and pitched the idea to him. Well, Simon Buckner agreed, and so Simon Buckner went to the Orphan Brigade reunion in 1907.
The Orphan Brigade.
Orphan.
Orphan Brigade.
Yes.
Okay. And what? I've never heard that term before.
Okay. The Orphan Brigade is a group of men across the state of Kentucky who joined the Confederate Army against the wishes of their communities and weren't allowed to come back home. Thus, orphans.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Breckinridge was their commander.
Okay.
So the Orphan Brigade members agreed wholeheartedly. And so from that point on, the members of the Orphan Brigade and the United Daughters of the Confederacy came together and started a fundraising campaign. And by 1917, they had raised enough money to start the construction of the monument.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1918, they had to stop because of World War I. And then when the war was over, they resumed. And then they had to stop again because they ran out of money. So they had to go back and do some more fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started back. And then right at near the end, they ran out of money, and they appropriated the last $15,000 from the state of Kentucky to finish the building of the monument.
Okay. And this is notable for many reasons. Certainly part of it is that people don't expect to see a monument rising out of the cornfields of
yes.
western Kentucky.
Right.
But beyond that, it's also notable because it's the largest unreinforced concrete structure.
Yes.
So is it still standing tall, or is it threatening to fall over?
Oh, no, it's still standing tall. It's,
uh-huh.
it's strong. It's 92
strong.
Years old.
92 years old. And how tall is it again?
351 feet.
351 feet. And people have probably heard some of the construction going on outside. It's being renovated now. You say it's done every 10 years?
Every 10 years we do a restoration and resealment.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty extensive going on out there. And you have been working here how long?
For 7 years.
For 7 years.
Yes.
And I will mention something, because this isn't television and people can't see you, but I have to admit,
I was a little bit surprised when I came into, I've been to many Confederate museums, and you are the first one in charge of a Confederate museum who is African-American.
Well, let me tell you, when my boss at the time, because I used to be the assistant manager of Lake Barkley State Resort Park.
Right, which is right down the road.
Yes.
Which is gorgeous, by the way.
Yes.
People should go there.
Well, I was the assistant manager there.
Mm-hmm.
And my boss, well, first of all, when this position was open, the manager of the park and myself was talking, and I said, you ought to apply for that position. He goes, you ought to go for it. I said, nah, given who I am and what that place is, they never give me the job.
Mm-hmm.
So we laughed it off, and a year later, my boss came to me and asked me if I take it.
Really?
Yeah, and because, well, she knew that I'd been in the military and that I was a history major.
Right.
She just didn't know that my emphasis was in the Civil War.
Right.
And I started laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, no, Ron, I'm serious. I said, yeah, I know you're serious. I said, it's an inside joke.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I took the job on May 16th, 2010, on May 17th, the local newspaper came and interviewed me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it hit the front page. African-American managing
right.
the birthplace of Jefferson Davis.
It is interesting.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, when it hit the AP.
Mm-hmm. AP picked it up.
Yes. I got interviewed from every small-time media all the way to the New York Times.
My goodness gracious.
Yes. And all they wanted to know was how and why.
And what did you tell them?
Well,
you told them. We heard the how. Tell me the why.
Well, I told them why not.
That's a great response,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And, but, I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, the obvious rejoinder to that is that, of course, Jefferson Davis is the president of the Confederacy.
Right.
The Confederacy, certainly the issue, the constitutional issue, was secession, but the underlying issue was slavery.
Right.
He was a slave owner.
Yes.
When you are here surrounded by him and by symbols of the slave, of the South and of the Civil War, I mean the Confederate battle flags that are on display, the other mm-hmm. Confederate imagery, one might expect that an African-American man would be uncomfortable in such a setting. But is that not the case?
Well, no. I'm not uncomfortable in the setting because I look at it objectively.
Uh-huh.
If you aspire to be a historian,
right,
then you can't let something that might cause a person to be unsettled, if you will,
mm-hmm.
to come into play, because
right.
then you can't be objective. And I've told people, I said, if you try to judge yesterday's history by today's morals, you'll get it wrong every time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to try to put yourself in their shoes and try to think how they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might come close.
Right.
I also look at the things that he did before the Civil War, the things that I told you about earlier,
yeah.
When he was a senator and when he was a Secretary of War, and all those things that he did that had a great impact on this country, which our history books don't teach.
Yeah, it's easy to vilify somebody like that, but, you know, anybody who came up with the Camel Brigade, I mean, he can't be all bad, right?
Can't be all bad.
He can't be all bad.
Yeah.
Well, Ron Sidner of the Jefferson State Memorial, what's the actual title of this place?
Jefferson Davis State Historic Site.
Jefferson Davis State Historic Site, which is 8 miles outside of Hopkinsville,
yes.
Kentucky. Thank you so much. I'd encourage people to come here and learn about this this very interesting figure in our history, and I thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, I appreciate you being here.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Ron Sidnor, the manager of the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site near Hopkinsville, Kentucky. You really need to get out there. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute, though we didn't have one today, didn't have time, sorry, is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.